everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Sunstone Fireside Podcast. I am one of your hosts, Blair Osler. I'm really excited today for this podcast because I get to do a meet and greet and an interview of one of our fellow podcasters. Christina, can you say hi to everyone?
Hello.
Christina is super awesome and super cool, and you guys get to share and embark in the journey of me getting to know her because I don't know her at all. And I'm excited for the opportunity to be able to introduce you to Christina, and we look forward to hearing more podcasts from her. So Christina, let's just jump right into it. And I'm not even going to give an intro because by the time this is over, we're going to know everything there is to know about you, right?
Sure. Well, let's see where it goes. I'm always one that overshares, so people learn a lot really quickly.
We love oversharing at Sunstone. Okay, so let's go ahead and start at the beginning then. What has your experience been with Mormonism as far as like, were you a convert? Were you born and raised in the church? How were you first introduced to Mormonism?
Yeah, so I was born and raised in the church. I was born in a little place called Waddell, Arizona. Actually, Glendale, but we lived in Waddell out by the White Tank Mountains and the Air Force Base out there. I grew up playing in the ditch across the street and making mud pies. We lived in the middle of nowhere. It was great. And my dad
Wait, really fast. You said that you lived on a military base. So you're a military brat.
No. We lived near the Air Force Base. We were so far out there that there was an Air Force Base out there. That's pretty okay. much, if anyone knows anything about Waddell, Arizona, the only thing they know is that there's an Air Force Base. And the only time somebody will know that is if they're in the Air Force. I'm like, yeah, I used to live out there.
Gotcha. Okay. So keep going. Your parents?
So my parents, my dad is from Indiana. And my mom is from California. They met in Fresno and they dated for 2 years. That's a fun, dramatic story. And they got married in the Manti Temple. My dad was a seminary teacher and then he started working for BYU as a fundraiser. He retired from that a while ago. I can't remember quite when. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. She had 6 children, including myself. She taught piano. Yeah. So, and then later my dad became a bishop. And after he was done as a bishop in Arizona, we moved to Utah when I was 10, so that he could work at BYU as a fundraiser instead of, you know, offsite, I guess.
So back up then, what was your experience like having your dad as a bishop?
You know, I don't remember a whole lot because I was so young. I mean, when he started, I would have been around 5, 6 years old.
Okay.
And he was released right before we moved. And so he actually was supposed to move for work to BYU. But when they found out he was being called as a bishop, he stayed in Arizona and did his term as a bishop.
Okay.
So I remember him being up on the podium, sitting in the pews with my mom. I remember if we acted out, my dad would literally get up at the podium and tell us to be quiet in front of the entire ward.
Dang!
Nothing ever settled in my family. So yeah, mostly, I mean, for a lot of my little kid years, my dad was up on the podium. So I didn't really grow up sitting next to him in the pews the way that some people might, you know. Unless your dad was a bishop or stake president.
Right. So then you guys moved out to Utah. You said you were about 10?
Yeah. So we moved out to Utah in 1999 when I was 10 years old. So I'm very young.
Yeah, you are. You're a baby.
Turning 31 this year. Woo. So yeah, we moved out to Utah to Springville area. And yeah, so I went to 5th grade in Springville at Sage Creek Elementary School. That was great. And
was there any culture shock moving from California to, or sorry, from Arizona to Utah? Or was it just pretty much like, oh, okay, cool, new thing?
Yes. So when we first moved, one of our first snows that we had, my parents built a home. And so we had dirt. There was no grass yet when winter came. And my siblings and I were so excited to be able to build a snowman for the first time. I had only seen snow like one time in Flagstaff. So this was a whole new experience. It was also freezing cold. I still hate the cold. There's a reason I moved out to California. So that was definitely new. But I remember my sister and I made a snowman and it was all muddy and we got a mop and made it into hair and like grabbed a tiny baby carrot that we could find because its nose is supposed to be a carrot and put that in. So just the silly stuff.
You made a brown snowman.
Right. Yeah. Just like us.
Love it. Love it.
I'm half Mexican and the other half of us is German and Danish, but we call ourselves the Germexicans. So,
oh my gosh, I love it.
I don't know Spanish though. We did not grow up knowing Spanish. So, You know, I say I'm a sorry excuse for Mexican a lot of times, which is not true. That's kind of negative, but you know, I don't fit in the same way. But yeah, so it was definitely interesting coming to a place that was cold, that was not hot most of the year. And it was definitely interesting coming to a place that was so predominantly Mormon. Before, I think there was maybe one or two other families in my entire elementary school that was Mormon. So that was definitely new. That was a whole experience to come into a place where everyone's Mormon and everyone kind of dresses the same. I kind of joke that it's like the basic down east t-shirt and like knit skirt, and that is Utah.
It's true. We all wear the same clothes here.
Right. And nobody swore. There was lots and lots of creative ways to get around swearing.
Gosh darn it. And,
right. I have made up for that.
That's really interesting because I remember for me too, growing up, my dad was in the military. So I was a military brat. We moved around a ton. And that was one of the biggest shocking things for me coming out to Utah, because I lived in places like Korea where most people don't even like speak your language, let alone, you know, your church. Like we would meet like in the basement of a complex building, you know, but like moving to Utah, it is the weirdest thing to be like, I'm going to do visiting teaching. I'm going to walk next door. You know? Right.
And that's that was always the funny thing. So we had two churches, like a block in either direction from our home, basically, or two blocks. And when we first got there, we went to one, and then by the end, we went to the other, which was a whole big thing because they split the wards and everything. Mm-hmm. But we always laughed that the one that was the closest to us was not the one that we were in the ward of, but it was only closer by like the distance of one house.
Yeah. So, right. Well, and it's so funny too. You go over one whole street and it's like, that's a different stake.
Oh yeah. No, our neighborhood was very like, our ward boundaries were very small. I thought that was so strange. And the stake center was, you know, it was like a mile or two away, but in Arizona, it felt like we drove forever, which maybe it wasn't really that far away, but it was a couple towns away from us, especially because we live so far out. And so going to church and going to, you know, to the stake house was always a big deal because it was farther away. It took time. And we wanted to be on time to look good because my dad was the bishop.
Sure. So what was the culture like? Was the culture of the church different, or was it pretty similar going back from California to Utah?
You know, I'm sure the culture was different to some extent, but again, I was so young when I was out there that I kind of just did my own thing. I feel like I've heard stories growing up of the ward that we were in, and there were a lot of people, I think, that were more laxed with kind of maybe some of the rules that they would follow when it came to, you know, maybe modesty or you know, maybe drinking or something like that. You know, they had slightly looser rules.
Right. And if you're reading the latest research, millennials are allowed to drink. It's part of the word of wisdom. So
Right. You can definitely find a way around it.
If people see you with a beverage in your hand, just be like, it's cool. I'm a millennial. It doesn't apply to me.
Right. I mean, and there were a few scandals. I can't remember all the details. I'm sure if my family hears this, they'll be like, you got all the stories messed up. I'm like, what? I don't know if you expect. I know there was a few, like, the young women group was very small, and I think there was one or two women that were pregnant or something. Like, so it was just different.
Honestly, the church was like kind of founded on scandalous behavior anyway. So it just
right. Came, like, hard. So we actually were better Mormons than the Utah Mormons. We were leaning in.
More authentic for sure. Okay. So then you move out to Utah when you're 10 and you're adjusting a new experience. How is your adolescence in the church?
Adolescence is interesting. I was always too brown and too big, and my boobs were always too big to actually be somebody that one of the boys would want to date. People would be interested in me, but I was the girl that nobody ever wanted to take home. And I had many boys tell me that they liked me or were interested in me, but they were too concerned that they might do something wrong if they went out with me because I had boobs when I was like 12.
Right.
And I'm not, no offense to the blonde girls out there in Utah, because there's so freaking many, but I'm not the skinny blonde hair, blue eyed, like typical Utah girl. I was not that. So I didn't fit in that way. I mean, I grew up with parents who are very devout. So I grew up with, you know, being taught about modesty and how modesty is basically only covering your entire body.
You know, right. That's what
modesty in any other context. You know, don't ever drink or do drugs. Don't have sex before marriage, because then you're like chewing gum, you know, all the very typical, stuff. Going back, by the way, Arizona, our ward was not some like girls gone wild. There were definitely people who were devout. I definitely know that like, from what I've been told, that ward was interesting, and the experience was just different.
I love that you just had to clarify that girls gone wild wasn't your ward. That's awesome.
Anyways, goodness, this is embarrassing. I grew up with the typical conservative Mormon views. I remember one of the things I've come to now in my later years, so much later, you know, because I'm 30, is kind of accepting that I'm bi. And I didn't know that growing up, nor did I know that that was okay. And I remember as a very young kid, like 5 or 8 years old, hiding behind my parents' piano with the JCPenney's catalog, looking at the women in lingerie, and like,
oh my gosh.
And I didn't know what to do with that.
Oh my gosh. No, seriously, you just made me the happiest interview ever. I did not know you were bi before I interviewed you. I'm bi.
Oh yeah. I should have mentioned that before.
Oh no. You don't have to disclose your sexual orientation to me, but like,
I'm really open about it.
I'm thrilled. So like, just to commiserate here with you for a minute, I remember taking my mom's Victoria's Secret catalogs and looking at the women too and thinking, oh my gosh, this is like the best thing ever. Like, so you're totally in the same boat as me. I love this so much.
Right. So that hasn't been figured out till like the last few years that I was like, oh, maybe that's a thing and maybe it's okay. That's something I'm learning right now and like traversing right now. But as a adolescent in Utah with very conservative parents, like that wasn't a thing. And so I remember masturbating, but not knowing what I was doing was masturbation.
You're like, I love it. You're like, I invented this thing. It's amazing.
I didn't know what it was. I'm like, why do I feel so good? And then I'd feel ashamed because I'm like, there has to be something wrong with this. But I didn't know what it was. I remember when I was like in high school, like somebody telling me about it, and I was like, of course I never do that. That's so wrong. And I'm like, oh no. I'm going to burn out.
And you're like, of course, so I've never looked at a JCPenney catalog. I told
everyone who will ever listen to this podcast about my sexuality as a teenager. So that's great.
So I have to ask then. So like for me, when I was figuring out what bisexuality was and stuff in my youth and recognizing I was obviously attracted to women, but I didn't have the vocabulary to identify it as bisexual because I was like, oh, but I like boys, so I'm not gay. That was my thing. Like, I'm not gay, but I like boys. But I was just like, of course everyone likes girls. Who wouldn't?
Right? No, definitely very, very similar. And I was trained to like boys. I was trained. That is how you are a righteous woman. And something that I've come to later, and this is part of why my situation currently with the church is so hard, is I was a true believer. And I don't think that's unique, but I was a true believer and I believed everything so firmly. And as I've grown up, to start extracting out all of that and reviewing it and trying to piece my life back together, it's been really hard because I'm just like, well, what parts of this do I keep and what do I get rid of? Because it's just ingrained in my whole person. And so it was hard then to feel like who I was and what I was doing was wrong. Mm-hmm. And a sin, and that I would burn in hell, and that I would never be with my family ever again. And I didn't know how to confront that for the longest time. Like, literally, I don't think I truly understood what my experience was or what I was doing until maybe 18, till I was in college. And then let alone with bisexuality, that hasn't been till much later that I even like truly started figuring out what that meant and understanding and kind of trying on and figuring out how that made me feel, that kind of identity.
Well, and it's such a process too. There's like the process of one kind of like coming out to yourself and recognizing this part of yourself that you're totally right. And I feel like when you're bi, it's almost easier to hide it from yourself because you, like you said, you're trained to like boys. So, okay, that's the thing that I'm going to focus on. And right. So you really deny this other part of yourself and it's like dormant. And it's almost like it's own process of coming out to yourself and be like, oh my gosh, I am attracted to other people to other women or other genders or things like that.
Exactly.
And then on top of it, like what you're saying, accepting that with yourself and then accepting it like as a label identity, that's like a whole different process of itself.
It's so ridiculously messy. It's so messy. And I'm kind of glad that I'm figuring this out now that I'm older because I've had therapy. I've learned more language because you know what? If I came out when I was 18, that would have been a whole different kind of messy that I don't think would have been okay considering my health and my life.
So I have to ask then, so have you, we're on a podcast. Have you been out publicly long?
No, actually. I've been out publicly with people in my life in San Diego for the most part, but I was totally the person who basically came out on Facebook. Nice. I'm not currently close with my parents at all. And a few of my siblings, because of that, are not close to me either. So I have never come out to my parents. The likelihood of them knowing is possible, considering I have aunts and uncles who are on my Facebook that I stay in touch with. Mm-hmm. From my dad's side, who would definitely say something, I think. But you just never know. So I actually don't know. And I kind of made a conscious choice to just embrace myself. And I have gotten rid of a lot of toxic relationships in my life, which was very hard and painful. And it's unfortunately that had to be include my parents. And I just think, you know what, there may be a day that I see you at a family event and that you know this information potentially, and there could potentially be some kind of conversation that's really uncomfortable, but I don't care because I don't care about their opinion about me. I don't anymore. Mm-hmm. Their opinion of me was very harsh growing up. I don't think they realize that. I love my parents. Don't get me wrong. I really do. I don't think they realize that I truly love them, but their broken and their messy caused a lot of pain for myself. And so I don't say that flippantly necessarily, but I don't care about people's opinion of me that don't uphold who I am because I know who I am now.
Well, I so much feel and understand what you're saying and how I think you do kind of get to that point at some times. And I can only imagine too. I mean, I'm pretty white. I'm not a person of color, but I could imagine like the intersections of like coming to grips with your bisexuality and living in like this very conservative Orthodox experience, plus being a woman of color. And then it just kind of being like, you almost like by default have to start being like, look, I just don't care what you think about me anymore because some of your perceptions are wrong and you don't want to even hear me explain myself anyway. So it's just like, I don't care what you think anymore.
Right. And I learned early on that I would have to take care of myself. Not that my parents never helped me with anything. They definitely did, but it was always kind of messy. There was always a lot of shame for ever needing anything. And so I'm at a point in my life where they're not necessary. And that makes that bravery a lot easier. People whose lives are intertwined with their family and their family is messy in this space, I'm not shocked that they don't come out or that they're not aggressive about who they are and their identity because it's hard. It's hurtful. It's painful. And in some cases it's dangerous. And so, but for me, I mean, I'm a single mother living on my own, like taking care of my life, and my parents are not in charge of my life. And so for me to claim who I am aggressively, it allows me to be brave and be like, you know what? I love you and I wish we could have a different relationship, but we don't. And you know what? I don't care what you think about me. So you can think I will burn in hell and that's fine. And if I do, I'm going to have some really cool people down there. I'm so excited for it.
We'll be there with you. We'll be there with you. And like, so I know we just met, but can I say I'm so freaking proud of you? That is amazing.
Thank you.
Proud of you. Like it really is to assert oneself as independent as constantly being held down to the opinions and feelings of others when it's just like at some point you liberate yourself.
Yeah.
You're amazing. Awesome. Let's go back a little bit then. So your adolescence, you were coming to grips with your own sexuality, looking back on it in retrospect, coming to grips with your sexuality in a sense and everything. So growing up then and going through high school, did you go to college after? What was after high school?
Yeah. So I actually went to Dixie State College. Now it's a university, but yeah, so I graduated from Springville High School and I went to Dixie, and I remember applying there mostly because I wanted to be in a warm place. Arizona never left my blood. It just never has. I have been trying to find ways to get out of that godforsaken place for so long. And no offense, Utah is lovely and wonderful for a lot of reasons and Bessie for a lot of reasons, but I really, really hate the cold with a fiery passion.
You brought up weather like three times now. So,
oh yeah, no, it's extremely important. Well, and in another context, I manage OCD and bipolar, and I have seasonal affective disorder. And so that is part of why winter is so hard. That's part of why why I feel so strongly, but I also just really like sunshine.
Yeah.
Totally. So that's part of the like insistence, but yeah. So I moved to St. George because I wanted to get away. I wanted to be able to kind of establish who I was on my own. And I felt like it was close enough to be close to family if I needed it, but far enough away to have some independence. And my father did not like that. He was not encouraging my parents. I mean, I think my mother wanted to help me as much as she could, but my dad is the patriarch of the family, which he has reminded us multiple times on many occasions. And he did not like that a young woman would be leaving the family in that way. So I remember having arguments. I'm sure they wouldn't even pose it this way, but yeah, he didn't want me to leave. He doesn't want the women to leave. My other two sisters and myself have all left. So it's a universal gender thing in our family.
Poor dad.
So really.
Was he working at BYU?
Yes, he was at the time.
Gotcha.
or was that? So my dad worked at BYU and then he took early retirement to do some business venture on his own, which is a semi-mistake. And then he eventually went and got a job at the University of Utah, doing the same fundraising. He always joked that taxes paid better than tithing. But he bleeds blue. So I think around that time is actually when he switched to the University of Utah. And then soon after took retirement after that job.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so then you're at Dixie, and how long were you at Dixie, and what was your experience like there?
I was at Dixie for 2 years. It was really fun in some ways and really hard in others. I moved down there and I was insistent that I was going to be a strong and faithful Mormon, that I was not going to be the girl who moves away from school and like falls off the face of the earth and ends up becoming a heathen, one of the women, young women in my ward was like the epitome of the perfect young woman and went off to school, and she was in my year. And she went off to school, and my parents always thought that was such a horrible idea. And she ended up having a really hard experience. Well, hard is a little bit harsh. She ended up having a different experience. That is a better way to pose it. I don't want to judge somebody's life that I'm not in connection with. It's not my space. But so she had a different space. She left the church and kind of went on that path. And my parents were so insistent that we never, you know, we stay true to the church. We don't want to become like that. And I felt vindicated or something, because I remember my dad telling me about this person and what happened to them. And I was like, wow, it's amazing that you compared me my whole life to that person while we lived in that neighborhood. And now that person's life is a version of what you think is horrible, and I'm doing just fine over here. So that was very validating.
Well, and it's so interesting too, how we take other people's stories, like in Mormonism, sometimes like we take other people's stories, and especially people who have left the church and been like, oh, this is your cautionary tale. This is your warning tale. Just don't let this happen to you, because we have the, you know, prodigal whomever, whatever. Right.
Yeah. Now, if I look back, if I were to ever meet that person, I would just be like, I'm so glad you figured I'm so glad you went on your own path. Like, that's important. And now I am the cautionary tale. So that's a whole different story. But yeah, so Dixie was great. I immediately went to church and I actually had a lot of fun. Being a single person in the church is kind of fun. Like, you're in a singles ward, you have your singles ward family, everyone gets a mom and pop and brother and sister title, which is ridiculous. And you have lots of activities, and it's just geared towards keeping you in the church and keeping you entertained. And so I went religiously. I loved it. I loved being a single Mormon girl. And
so, question really fast. So how was it at Dixie? I went to school here in Provo. I'm still in Provo. So how was the experience for you going to Dixie as far as like pressure to get people married?
There was still definitely that pressure.
Okay.
Yeah, no. I mean, we were not that far away. We were still definitely in Utah. So the pressure was very much on. Yeah. But I had a lot of fun. And I always laughed because people always said that Dixie was such a party school. I think that idea still kind of exists, like in Utah.
Yeah.
And it's such a joke because it's so not a party school. Granted, some people would disagree with me, because I remember one time, we're so close to Vegas. We're like an hour and a half away.
Right.
And I remember somebody went to Vegas and they give out those porn cards when you're walking on the street.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
And somebody collected a bunch of them and like released them at the dorms, which was an outside building. Like, the doors led outside. So just released them, and they were scattered everywhere one night. So that was kind of funny. So I guess you could say that was a party school. I mean, scandalous. I know there were probably apartments that, you know, had parties that good Mormon girls would, you know, be scandalized by, but that exists in any college town. So,
well, anytime I go by my in-laws live at St. George. So we go to St. George relatively frequently, but every time I go past Dixie now, I'm just going to think of like porn confetti in the air. Just like,
which I think is great. That's like, that's the explosion of the celebration as you lead into Vegas. Like, just exactly. Embrace the porn cards raining from the sky. So I went there, and I remember
study?
Initially, I actually went down there. I wanted to become a paramedic. My major has changed so many times, it's not even funny. So I went down there initially to become a paramedic, but I went and got my EMT basic certification. I took a whole class that semester. And then the next year I did my intermediate, which is like the next level up. Basic is more like first aid with slightly more skilled, like things that you learn to save lives. Intermediate, they taught you how to use some basic medications, start IVs, and intubate people, but it was still basic compared to what a paramedic can do. So I did both of those when I was there and took some basic classes. My first semester, I did great. And my second semester, depression set in, and that was a lot harder. And my second year, my dad had to have heart surgery. And that was really hard on me. My depression increased, my anxiety increased, but I wasn't taught how to manage my mental illness. Though my mother very much believes in mental illness. She has had to manage it in her life, but she had to do that in the 70s and 80s and 90s, and that's completely different than the 2000s. And my father wasn't big on therapy or things like that because he felt like it was useless. And I think he believes in mental illness, but not really. It's kind of a messy space. So I didn't really have the support I needed to do well. And so it was really, really hard that second year. Like the excitement, the hypomania excitement going into new school and a new experience had worn off. And when my dad had to have surgery, it was really hard and really scary for our whole family.
Reading is weird. It takes up your whole body. You can't walk, you have to hold a book in your hands, and you have to look at words the whole time. That's why you have me. I'm Stephen Carter, the host of the Sunstone Magazine podcast. I narrate Sunstone's best articles, essays, fiction, and poetry for you. So you can do dishes, or rock climb, or drive your Ferrari, or skydive. Whatever it is you like to do while listening to the best of Mormon thought and experience. Listen to some of our free episodes at patreon.com/sunstone. And then join the We Do Fun Stuff While Learning About Mormon Stuff Club. I'll see you there.
So then at what point did you start experiencing more of a faith transition? Did that come till later?
Oh, much later. That has been in the last 5 years.
Oh, okay. So how did we get to that point? What happened in between there?
So I was at Dixie for a couple of years, and then I moved back to up to Springville, and then enrolled in UVU, and that was a whole messy. That time I met some really good roommates and there was some really good fun things there. That singles ward is still one of my favorites. I'm still close to some of those people and I love them dearly. And my announcement on Facebook, I actually was really glad that I've curated an special kind of people because nobody was shocked and nobody said anything and it wasn't a big deal. And I was like, thank goodness. I don't need anyone emailing me, telling me that I need to be prayed for. And anyone who has different ideas, they haven't reached out and I'm okay with that.
Right. It's okay to keep that to yourself.
Yeah. And UVU is where I met my husband, my ex or almost ex-husband. And, that's kind of the beginning of the end, actually. I met my husband, we got married in Manti Temple, and
how was that experience for you? Your first time going through the temple and stuff. Did you have any noteworthy experiences?
I did actually. So my sister, my little sister, got married like 2 or 3 weeks before me. It was a crazy summer. And so I decided I wanted to take my endowment out before she got married so that I could be in the temple, for her ceremony. And I really like that I did it, though it was connected to me getting married. Like, I did it on my own instead of doing it, you know, the week before I got married and the things that exist around your husband and everything in the temple. Anyways.
Yeah.
So I got to do that on my own, though my husband, I'm just going to reference this husband right now because that's easy. Though my husband was there at the temple and his side of the family, some of them came. Like, it got to be my own experience. And I remember I loved initiatory.
I did too.
Well, so it's really funny because I think, how did I not know I was bi? And how did I not know that I was like a bad A intersectional feminist? I mean, my favorite right? movie growing up was Mulan. Like,
yes.
Come on. And when I went to, and I mean, I think that's another thing. Like, I went and did my initiatory and it was so empowering. And I was told that I was divine and had power in a similar way as men, like that I was not as different as I was taught in church. And yeah. that was so empowering and so beautiful to me. And also, I am an old woman at heart and I really loved wearing underwear that pulled up to my boobs. It was, that was me all the way. Everyone complained. And I was like, I feel like a hug all the time. It's beautiful.
It's like a big celestial hug to my body.
It was wonderful. So I leaned in on that. I remember when I did my endowment, I walked in and got really teary-eyed seeing my friends and family in white and just that all these people were together. I am not very different in the fact that I sat there and was like, this is weird and also boring.
Yeah.
There were some beautiful things, but mostly I'm like, okay, sure. Let's go back to the initiatories. Can we do that again?
Right.
Totally. That was far more powerful.
Yeah. My two favorite things are the initiatories and the ceilings.
And I do remember sitting in that room to this day, and this is kind of one of those woo moments, but, and feeling very distinctly like there was a little spirit that I just felt very strongly that I was supposed to have a kid soon, which I'm like, well, that fits into the Mormon storyline, but that's also crazy. Right. And I just remember feeling really bright and happy. Later when I had my son, I was like, oh, it's you. Okay. I get it now.
Oh, what's your son's name?
His name is Ray, like a ray of sunshine.
Oh, I love it.
He's
and how
wonderful.
Old, how old is Ray now?
He's 4 years old.
Yeah, fun.
But yeah, so the temple experience was wonderful and beautiful. But I had a really hard time after I got married because, I mean, my husband was supposed to be the leader and I was used to a patriarchal, you know, father leader who was very big on that. And he wasn't in the same way. And that was really hard. And there were other issues that I'm not going to get into.
Sure.
But yeah, it was, that was one thing that was hard. Our relationship was not as easy.
Did your faith transition happen during that time with your marriage or did it happen after the marriage ended?
Kind of during, when I first was married, everything was fine and dandy, or at least I wanted to convince myself. I was frustrated that I was taking on so much responsibility and it felt like he didn't take up the yoke. but was hailed as wonderful because he's a man in the church, you know? And so that was kind of like a beginning of being uncomfortable of like, why am I doing all the work? Why am I the one working multiple jobs to support you going to school? Because at one point we decided it wasn't savvy for me to go to school because, you know, you put the husband first. And, but I remember wanting to have a baby and he was like, no, not yet, which is valid. And yeah, so that was a point of stress. Finances were a point of stress, kind of all the kind of typical things. But so, it was really hard for me to be in a marriage where I felt like I had a very strong spiritual connection and I had a very strong belief. And to have somebody that believed by default, not out of, I don't know, I don't want to speak to their faith, but what the example they gave was simply like, I do this because I was told to. And I believed on a deeper level, and it was really frustrating to me. And when I started challenging views and questioning, he was always giving the answer of, well, you know, as a priest holder, like, I've prayed about it. And I think we just need to learn that we just need to accept things and that we're not going to know. And I'm like, that's not good enough. Mm-hmm. It's not good enough to not know why we kept the priesthood from Black people. It's not good enough to not have an answer as to why women are only supposed to have babies. It's not good enough. Like, those were the two initial, which is pretty common. That's not new for anyone who's like starts looking outside of the church. It wasn't okay that people who were LGBTQ were treated badly and were hidden away. And it wasn't okay that the ideas of sex were so messy. My ex watched pornography, and I actually came from a very kind approach to that and was never upset or angry about it, because I did too at some point, you know. And so we very much wanted to work on it together.
But it's only lesbian stuff, so it's okay.
It was a little both, but yeah, mostly lesbian, let's be honest. And so I was always trying to encourage us to be better, and I didn't want it to be a secret, and he struggled with that. There's a lot. This is just surface stuff. Sure. But anyways.
So then moving into more your faith transition, though, did that contribute? So
what really contributed to my faith transition was having my son. Things were so messy in my marriage, and things were so messy with my parents, and I was starting to question things, but I didn't know how to traverse that. And so I just shoved it down. And when I had my son, it was a really traumatic experience. My body never went into labor, but my water broke, and I ended up having to have an emergency C-section. Mm-hmm. And it was very traumatic for me. Mm-hmm. And after I had my son, it was like the most honest point of my life to be in such a scary space and then to hold this tiny new person. And I couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't carry my husband. I couldn't hold the weight of what my parents expected me to be with such unhealthy views. I couldn't balance everything. It was too much, but I wasn't ready to walk away. So within 3 or 4 weeks after my son was born, I went straight back to work. I was working two jobs, eventually got promoted and was able to work one job. My husband at the time couldn't hold a job, was constantly getting fired. I think we added up, it was something like he lost something like 20 jobs in 5 years. So I was taking care of everyone and everything and not myself. And in 2016, my depression was so bad, but I was balancing everything and nobody knew. I mean, people at work, I did rec therapy. I was a CNA for a long time. Eventually ended up in recreation therapy, which I loved. I love my old people too. And people didn't know. They thought I was happy. I was Disneyland. That was kind of the joke. I'm very caring, so I took care of people, and so nobody knew. But I was having suicidal ideations, which I had dealt with my entire life, so that wasn't new, but this was turning into plans. And my sister Jennifer came out to visit me, and she realized that I wasn't okay, and she realized that my marriage was really, really bad and ugly. And that the surface things that I've shared were literally just the surface. And so she decided to stay with me and made sure that I got help. And I remember it was so hard because I didn't ever want to die, but I just didn't want to hurt anymore. And I started to believe that my son would be better off. I was always told by my family and even my husband that my mental illness was kind of my problem, and that, you know, basically you're the crazy one and you have to deal with that. And so I was convinced that I was the problem and that the only way to save my family is if I took me out of the equation.
I'm so sorry. I am so sorry, Christina. I know that feeling.
Right. And it was, you know, when you have bipolar and OCD and you add on postpartum, like that is an ugly space. And
that's heavy. That is.
And I think my heart hurts sometimes when I think of the first 2 years of my son's life. It was lots of parents yelling and his mother so depressed she couldn't get off the couch and crying constantly. And I got sick a couple of times with like crazy, I got like a weird staph infection in my ear, which led to C. diff, which is gross and personal, but it's horrible. And it was just like on top of the depression and like trying to manage new meds, which was, you know, fun. And so, but 2017 came and I went to my parents' ward and I listened to this talk about this couple. And the guy tells a story about how he went to school, his wife supported them, very stereotypical story. And he just kind of goofed off. And one day he kind of blew off a big interview after he graduated. And his wife came home in the middle of the day and he was there with a buddy. And she was just very quiet and like, okay. And he realized he was in trouble. So he shooed his friend away after she left from her lunch break. And he like cooked dinner and did all the things. And when she came home, she said, I quit my job. So it's your turn. It's your turn to take on, you know, to take on and do the next step. And I listened to that and I had chills and I'm like, that's what I'm doing. I can't do this anymore. And it's not my job to carry us anymore. And I went to my husband and I said, I'm not okay. And I have told you for years and I have done all of the things and you're not willing to help and you're not willing to take up your own responsibilities and I can't do this anymore. And I quit my job and told him he had to figure it out. And he really struggled. It was his last semester of college as well. And he didn't know how to support his family because I had always done it. Mm-hmm. And we were paying off debt from a baby and all this stuff. It was messy. And I remember having a conversation with him. An opportunity came to move out to Fresno to help my grandmother. And I remember having a conversation with him about his issues that he faced. And I basically told him, I was like, well, either you're struggling and you need help, and in which case I can stay and we will work on this together as long as you're committed to doing that. I'm like, or you're actually too lazy and you don't love me enough to do these things, which maybe some therapists might think is a little bit messy, but you know what? That's where it was. Without any context, that's where it was. And I remember him looking at me really sheepishly and he said, I guess I'm just lazy.
Wow.
And I was heartbroken. Wow. And so I decided to move to Fresno. And when I moved to Fresno, there were so many issues with the church that I had, but I didn't know how to articulate. And so many, and I'd worked so much, so I was able to get away with not going on Sunday all the time because I had to work. I worked in healthcare, like you have to work. And when I moved out to Fresno, I went to church a little bit. I remember meeting with my bishop and the first time I met with him, he asked if I was cheating on my husband, if that's why I left. And I laughed and he's like, are you laughing because it's true? And I said, no, I'm laughing because that's ridiculous. So that was fun.
Wow.
And I don't know, I can't pinpoint like all the specific reasons. But I never fit into Mormonism. I wasn't white enough and to fit in to Utah Mormonism. And even though I have pioneer ancestry, my family didn't allow us to truly claim that. My mother and her family were mocked constantly by my dad and his side. And he used being brown as a badge of, you know, being a victim, but also wanted to be the perfect Mormon so that he was better than his family, because that's messy. And so I don't know, it's very messy. And so we didn't claim my mother's heritage because we claimed the Mexican side, and the Mexican side was really messy. And so I didn't even know I had pioneer heritage till much later in my life. And I don't know, it was just, I didn't fit. And the more I came to terms with my sexuality and the more I accepted that my heart is truly kind and loving, and the more I saw people outside of the church or even in the church who didn't fit. It didn't make sense. Why are we not opening our arms to everyone when we're taught that every Sunday? It doesn't make sense. And why are we teaching people that their power is limited if they don't have a penis? That's ridiculous. And why are we telling people that they can't have an eternal family if they don't look the right way? And why are we shaming people who are single? Why are we shaming people who are divorced? Why are we shaming people who are transgender? Why are we shaming people who are, you know, other parts of the LGBT? Why are we shaming men who don't fit in and don't
amen, fit masculine? Amen.
Like so many things, so many things. Why are we shaming children sexually? Like it just goes on forever. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't exist in a community that didn't match my heart. Not to say that I'm better than Mormonism, because I'm not. If you met me, I am a salty, like swearing sailor, and I have a big kind heart, but you know, I'm not always fun.
I'm liking this so far, Christina. I'm loving all of it.
So it was really, I don't know. It was just kind of, I had my son and it was like my life, I did all the things right. And how am I so unhappy? And even after I started taking care of my mental health, the healthier I got, the more I realized that I was not the problem.
Amen.
I was not the problem, that my environment, the teachings that I was taught, and the people who were in my life that could not support me in a healthy way, those were a big part of the problem as to why I was destroying myself. I was destroying myself to fit in. I was always trying to fit in. I always wanted to be accepted. I wanted the boy to like me so that I could be the one that got taken to home. I wanted to be the one that people were proud of. I wanted to be that. And I wanted to be the epitome of the stay-at-home wife when I was younger. And the more I took those roles off my shoulder and the more I learned to love me and the more I got healthy and stable and the more I became independent and individual, I realized I don't want any of that.
Mm-hmm.
And my ex came out to Fresno and it was still ugly and hard. And so he moved out. And eventually moved back to Utah in May of 2008. And I was without a home. And I came to Utah and stayed on Jerilyn Poole's couch for 2 weeks while I got a hug from my family and was like trying to figure out how I was supposed to rebuild my life with a four-year-old and a person who was not going to be involved, like was not willing to help me at all. And then I came back to California because I knew that I had to be in California, the divorce. Otherwise, it would be even messier in Utah. And I had, before we left Fresno, my sister was looking into, Jennifer stayed with me. Jennifer Gonzalez is my sister. She stayed with me this whole time. She gave up 3 years of her life to make sure that her sister survived. And I'm forever grateful.
Oh, sisters are kind of the best that way.
Right. And she was the only person who could do it. No one else in my family was in a position to do it. And
okay, we all love Jennifer here. We all love Jennifer.
Right, who doesn't? Like, let's be honest. And so we were looking into like homeless shelters and like women's shelters. And I was like, well, I'm going to go to Utah. And gratefully, I got a travel agreement signed. I didn't even know that was necessary, but I'm so glad in retrospect that I was like, I'm a detailed, organized person. So we're going to do this before I leave the state. And after the 2 weeks, I came back to California. In the meantime, a friend of hers found out that I needed a place and was willing to take us on. So I lived there for 2 months in Palo Alto, and it was beautiful and it was wonderful. And there was this beautiful park, and I took my son every day, and I cried every day because my marriage was dead and because I didn't know where I existed, where I was supposed to be in my religion, and because I felt abandoned by my parents, and because my sister was then in Mexico, and I felt so alone. Mm-hmm. And everything I thought I was working towards burned down. And I had made decisions to take next steps that I knew were going to mean that a lot of those things were going to break down. But I only took them because I knew that it was either conforming to what everyone wanted or surviving. And I chose surviving. And I chose that I wanted to be healthy and stable so that my son could grow up with a mother who was healthy and stable. That's, I wanted that. I wanted to find a way to be healthier than my parents because I love them, but they did not manage their broken in a way that was useful to their children. And I didn't want to repeat that step. And so we were there for 2 months, and I remember I looked all over for an apartment. And are you kidding me? It is not easy to find an apartment when you have a terrible credit score and you don't have a job. All I had was a good resume. I don't have a job. I have a four-year-old, and California is expensive. Nobody wants to live with a single mother with a kid. And I was searching for 2 months, and I found this little studio room in the home of this couple. They're good Christian people. They're not Mormon, but they are like, yeah, they're very religious and they're wonderful. But and she reached out to me, and I we've had this conversation later with one of my landlords and her husband. And so we talked one night, and she told me, she's like, I had a family lined up, and I was ready to rent to them, and you popped up. And I was like, well, I'll give her a try. And she called me, and like that day that I was in Palo Alto, I was like, I can be there by like Thursday. So I packed up my car and drove to Fresno, and the next day drove to San Diego. And I told them I was going to meet them at 4, and everything went wrong. And my son got sick, and I got there at like 9. And she told me, and she's like, you walked in and you smelled like puke, because my son had thrown up in the car like right as we got off the exit to go up a canyon, because I live up a canyon. And she's like, and I saw your quiet little kid, which they now know is not normal for him. And she was a single mother. And she's like, I had to give you what I had been given. I had to give you that. And that is the only reason that I was able to find a home and reestablish my life. Because at the time, I then ran out of money. And I couldn't pay for gas, and my computer died, so I couldn't even apply for jobs. It was a really hellish couple of months. My little sister, Anita, is amazing and was like, okay, we're going to solve this problem. She applied for jobs for me, and I was able to finally get a job in September of 2018. And through all of this, and I went to church. I kept going to church. I'm still considered, you know, a member, still on. I'm still on the records, and I went to church here because I needed resources, and I knew this is a place where I can get resources. And my ward is full of, there are a few great people, but there is a lot of horrible people. I live 30 minutes from the border, you guys, the border of Mexico. Right. And my ward had segregated primary classes until this year, because we have a lot of Congolese refugees in my ward that everyone treats nicely and is willing to give rides to them, but they hold a lot of horrible racist views. My ministering brother is a CBP officer and has a giant Trump flag, which, yes, that is a thing. People are like, a Trump flag, what's that? I'm like, just look it up. It exists. Oh, has a huge gosh. Trump flag flying in their front yard, which I only know because I let them watch my kid one time and I had no idea. And then I was like, oh, yeah, I hope you never know what I do in my free time. And my Relief Society president, one day in one of our classes, gratefully the Congolese members were gone for like a wedding, but she got up a lesson talking about loving our neighbor, and said that we need to learn to love even those that we don't agree with how they came to our country.
Wow.
I was like, are you kidding me? The last Sunday I went to, like, this ward is particularly bad, but it just amplified the things that I was already upset about that didn't have good enough answers, and that I've learned more and more that I was like, this is not okay. There's so many things that are not okay. My last Sunday was, again, some, I don't know, thinly veiled lesson about loving people, which was really, let's find as many ways as we can judge other people. And somebody brought up the LGBTQ community, and the whole entire room of these women went off about how gay people are horrible and disgusting and are sinners and deserve to be in hell, and how you know, we can give them love, but they are destroying this world. They are destroying the family. They are perverted, and just go on and on. And I couldn't handle it. And I raised my hand because I'm not going to come out to my ward. Are you kidding me? And right. I raised my hand. And the only thing I could say was like, okay, I can't let it be this way. And I was already mouthy in my ward. So people were, already, they tried to put me in primary early on. And I said no, because they didn't want me being mouthy and single. And I had cleavage. So that I did not hide. And so I raised my hand. I was like, because then they got on to transgender and how, you know, all this, all the things. I don't even need to repeat it. And I just said, as far as we can tell, based off of what everyone has said in this room, none of you are experiencing these things. Mm-hmm. None of you identify as somebody within this community. So none of you get to make comments about this experience. Like, we need to be very careful because you are not these people. And everyone's like, well, we have neighbors and friends. And I'm like, it doesn't matter. It is not the same. And I was like, we need to be careful and we need to give love, and we cannot make judgments on people that we don't experience the same way. We can't make judgments. And like, ended my comment. And you would think, being brave, that standing up, that people would stop talking. I heard one woman was like, well, I'm sorry I even brought it up, who was three people down from me. And you would think that would be the end, right? Nope. Somebody brought it up, and the rest of the meeting was just bashing on gay people. And mm-hmm. I came home that day and I called my sister and I bawled my eyes out. I'm like, I can't go back. I can't sit and hide who I am in a place that I was born into, that I love so deeply. That's what's hard. I'm like, you are my family. You are my culture, and you hate me. You hate me because I'm brown. You hate me because I'm not thin. You hate me because I like women. What's not to love about women? I mean, come on, we're wonderful.
You have me crying, Christina. You have me crying right now. You are an amazing, incredible woman. Like, what you are doing and going through, and how you're putting your life back together, and with your son, like, you are this amazing, wonderful person, and you deserve to be loved and in safe spaces and in a safe spiritual community. I'm so sorry. You had me in tears. I'm just over here crying.
Usually I would be like, oh, you know, whatever, but I have learned to embrace that. And you're right. I am amazing. And I appreciate that compliment. Like, we cannot be ashamed of who we are, and we get to embrace how wonderful we are, and we get to say thank you and not, oh, that's okay. No, no, no. I am done being that person. So thank you very much. Absolutely. Yeah, I left that lesson and I couldn't anymore. I couldn't. So I left under the guise of, I have to work on Sundays. And so my ward still believes I work on Sundays, which is not a lie. I just work in a way that they may not consider the same, that they wouldn't think is qualifying. And I go to beach Sunday, beach church is what I call. And I take my kid to the beach and he loves the waves. And I watch that happy kid swimming in the waves in the middle of November. There's another plug for weather. I am sorry, but it's like 80 degrees and you guys are freezing and we are swimming in the ocean. So I'm just putting that out there.
I love that.
And watching that beautiful kid in the ocean, that is God. That is heaven. And it doesn't have to be a kid, but to embrace beauty in the world, to embrace yourself, to love you, that is heaven.
Thank you so much, Christina. I am blown away. The listeners don't know this, but before I interviewed Christina on the podcast, she says she wasn't sure what she was going to say because it might be a little too boring. And this has been anything but boring. You are amazing. You're a champion. You're a warrior. And I'm so proud of you and what you're doing with your life. And I couldn't agree with you more that, for me, God is found in the connections. If it's you and your son at the beach, it's the connection with your sister when she helped take care of you, with Gerilyn letting you sleep on her.
You're so, right.
You know what I'm saying? It's like, right. It's found in the connections. But we're about out of time. Is there anything else you want to share or add or close with about your story? I'm just blown away. I feel like incredibly happy. I got assigned to interview you.
Thank you. I will do one last plug. So one of the things that has led to my happiness now, my life is far from easy. I am a working mother. I'm a single mother. I am brown, bisexual, and I'm going to school full time because I'm crazy. And I volunteer. And the organization I volunteer with is called Allies to End Detention. And I found community there. It has Joanna Brooks at the head. So anyone who knows that name knows, Yay. Of course, this is going to be good. And it has my sister, Jennifer Gonzalez, as one of the co-founders as well. And she is a badass. Sorry if you have to take that out. I can't say it any other way. And we are doing amazing work. We have gotten volunteers from all over to write individuals who have been detained on the border and the Otay Mesa Detention Center. And that has been such a powerful experience. But I went to this community only wanting to like lick stamps, and I have gotten far more involved now. And they have, and not just Joanna, but the people that have come together to do this work are wonderful and beautiful. And they are family to me in a way that I don't know if they truly understand, but it means so much to me to have people that I get to see every week on Monday night for my own FHE. And they love me and I love them, and we are doing the work. We have people who write these letters, and we have these individuals write back, and we push for, we're an activist group, so we push for change, and we have archived these letters at SDSU. Has been amazing. We've worked with them and have interns there, that have archived these letters there, and so that we can share these people's history and their story. Like we're creating a space so that they can share their history. We don't get to dictate it. They get to share it, and they get to tell us what's actually happening in those places. And it's horrible. You guys.
Right. Oh my goodness. It's so ugly.
And the stories that happen and the things that our country is doing to these people is horrible. I held a letter in my hand just a few weeks ago of a mother who had a child, and it sounded like she was on her own up here. And she was just taken away and put in detention and taken away from her child.
No.
And that child is with who knows.
No.
She wants to know where her child is. She wants to know what's happened. Her child, it sounds like, is a citizen. And she is in a detention. And if I can tell you anything, the likelihood of her staying in this country is very slim. And this happens to people all the time. And I held the letter of a transgender individual who has been raped repeatedly.
No.
In these places and on their journey to get here, like these people need us and we are destroying them.
Mm-hmm.
And we are self-righteous and we are not getting involved. And I got involved and I can't turn my back anymore. Like a lot of, and it's not just Mexico, you guys, it's all over the world.
Right.
We have Haitians, we have people from the Middle East, we have people throughout Latin America, we have people everywhere who are trying to escape horrible things, and they're coming and asking for refuge. And I'm sorry, but we are failing them. Any person who is good, and definitely any person who claims that they are a disciple of Christ, is failing these people, because they are not making sure that we're making choices as a country that allow to preserve their dignity and their humanity. We have destroyed them. We have destroyed them when they had nothing left. And these are strong people who have stood up in the face of horror and have said, no, I will not stand for this. And then they have escaped with their life. They are not cowards. They are not poor beggars. They are powerful individuals. And we are failing the world when we have the opportunity to help. And so...
So can people go make a donation to this, to the Allies?
Yes, so you can, if you go to Allies to End Detention, you can just look it up. You can make donations. You can also sign up to be a regular letter writer. You can write just one time. We've had people who like color pictures and send them in. And we send those to people, and we get letters back telling us all the time, like, thank you so much. Like, it made a huge difference. It is giving people saying that, like, it's giving them life inside an ugly place. It makes them want to keep going for one more week. Like, mm-hmm. it it's been amazing to hold these letters and to see these people's stories and to learn from them and to want to fight, not for them, but with them. Like, they are fighting for their lives and I'm not fighting for them. I'm doing the best to use my privilege to build a stage so that they can break through this war and take what they need to and own their life. And we are making it really hard for, like, as a country, we're making it really hard for these people. So you can definitely. And that is one thing that I love about this. So many people are like, how do I get involved? You know, there's so many things around me. And I'm like, I am a very busy single mother who at the time when I joined this organization was literally rebuilding my life. And all you have to do is write a letter. Mm-hmm. That's it. You just write a Facebook post and send it to somebody who needs love. Mm-hmm. That's it. That's all you have to do to be involved. And we want people to be educated and learn more and have a fire build inside of them to do more. But at the very least, you can write a letter. That's so easy. Mm-hmm. So yeah, my last plug would be claim yourself, love who you are, and use that fire to fight for those who need to have someone hold their hand. And make space for those people who have been marginalized, who have been hurt, who are being destroyed by ourselves, by our country, by our church, and give them love so that they can stand up and rise and that we can go forward with power and change the world. Like, that's what we need to do. That's what religion should be. That's something that I've learned that to some extent is kind of exist in Mormonism, but we've drowned it out with so much crap. And I'm just like, just embrace the divinity in you and find a way to reach out and it will make a difference.
Oh my goodness. Thank you so much, Christina. This has truly been my pleasure to interview you and get to know you. And honestly, I just feel like the power of a priestess talking. Like, you are embracing your divinity. And I love that you're encouraging everyone else to do that too. And again, plug for Allies to End Detention. Definitely go on there, make a donation, help how you can, write a letter and contribute. If Christina can do it, you certainly can do it too. Christina, thank you again so much. And thank you everyone for tuning in. And this has been another episode of the Sunstone Fireside Podcast. We'll catch you next time.